Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
The title of my talk is Love and Buddhism. Can they go steady? Okay, so kind of an unusual title. And I know what you're thinking. So we're going to talk about love tonight, right? And so when you hear that, we're going to talk about love, you think, another Dharma talk about love. Can't we talk about anything else besides love? Well, actually, we don't talk too much about it. Love and Dharma talks, and that's kind of why I thought it'd be good to focus on it. So it seems if you were to ask, you know, are Buddhists on the whole loving people? I think people would say that's kind of a silly question. Of course they're loving people. If you went around the world and asked all the non-Buddhists what they thought about the Buddhists, they would say, yeah, loving people, sure, why not? They're known to be peace-loving, and a lot of times they're vegetarians. And so, yeah, they're loving people. But I don't think we talk about it that much. And when I look at the literature, the Buddhist literature, I don't see it written a lot. I see it now and then, but not very much. And sometimes when you see it written about, it's kind of strange or, you know, eyebrow-raising, and so we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. So what is Buddhism known for, if not love? Well, it's known for wisdom and compassion. Those are the two words you really hear a lot about, wisdom and compassion. And those are good words, right? There's nothing wrong with wisdom and compassion. Let's think about compassion and love. Now, they're related, similar, but not the same. And I think you all know, you all have inside your minds, you know, good definitions of compassion and love. And we could go around and get, you know, detailed definitions, but here's a couple of just very kind of top-level definitions that we can work with. Compassion is caring about suffering, usually about people. It doesn't have to be. It could be about stray dogs or whales in the ocean, but usually people. So it's caring about suffering. Let's say people suffering. Love is caring also. It's caring about, again, it could be a person. You could love your dog. You could love the earth. You could love the tree outside your window. You could love all kinds of things. But it's caring. But it's caring really, really deeply in a way that's so strong and so profound that we have this special word, love. So those are two definitions for compassion and love. Now, sometimes I hear... My wife was just saying to me this evening, you know, I think it's Zen, I think it's kind of cold, and, you know, you're going to drop the ego and have some cosmic consciousness, and it's all good, but it just doesn't seem very personal. So I want to make it personal. I want to do that. So when we love something or somebody, it's very profound. And let's talk about people. So let's make it personal. When we love people, it's really important. And you can love, let's say you have a child. And I think for the parents in the room, they can understand how deeply you can love a child, how completely and totally you could love a child. But it can also be your brother or sister, your parent, just a really good friend. You feel very strongly about, you really love them. And also I want to include romantic love. There's no reason to exclude romantic love. Now, I'm not talking about sexual attraction, which certainly can coexist with romantic love, but talking about romantic love. And for some of us who have spouses or significant others, you can know how strong that feeling is. And for some of us who were single, maybe you're single, and even those who are not single can remember that, you might go to bed at night and think, oh, gee, I wish I had somebody to hold. I wish there was a special person in my life. And that's a very deep, strong love that we have for each other. And that's what makes us human, right? When we can love each other. So, lest you think I'm making... So that sounds good. But what about the business about the Buddhism and love? You know, do they really belong together? Well, so what I want to do right now, or next, is read a little bit of literature. Just little snippets here and there of some Buddhist literature, and then a little bit of non-Buddhist literature for comparison. And see how that sounds to you. And then first I'll read it's a short, little short section, and then I'll tell you the citation, where it came from. Seek no intimacy with the beloved. For not to see the beloved is painful. From endearment springs grief. From endearment springs fear. From affection springs grief. From affection springs fear. That is from probably the most popular of all Buddhist writings, the Dhammapada. It's kind of striking, at least striking to me. It sounds really off-putting. It's kind of scary, really. You shouldn't love anybody. You shouldn't be affectionate to anybody. I checked some other translations. I suppose, you know, this is a weird translation. No, it's kind of standard translation. Okay, well, that's the Dhammapada. Now, for a non-Buddhist comparison, just a real short one is, all you need is love. That's from a Beatles song by John Lennon. So, I was going to ask you, I think maybe I will, if you were going to vote, which of those two different pieces of literature, if you will, you prefer, which one would you vote for? Would you vote for, well, let's see, maybe you can vote. This is a democracy, everybody can vote. So raise your hand if you want to vote for the Buddha. Which of those pieces you like better?
But you have to define like.
In your heart, which that one do you like? Okay, which one? Who prefers John Lennon? Okay. Okay. Well, I just thought, you know, it's a democracy, so you know. It's good to check, see what you think. And so John Lennon won that one out pretty easily. But I looked around. When I went to put this talk together, I did ask myself, am I like, you know, looking for weird things? You know, am I trying to make a talk out of some strange stuff? You know, that's really just obscure. And you know, I was really trying to get to the heart of it. What's really kind of mainstream Buddhist literature. And Dhammapada, of course, is as mainstream as you can get. But here's another one. Here's a Zen one. Do not cling to love and affection, which is more foolish than the behavior of birds and beasts. If we do not let go of our loved ones, chances are that our loved ones will let go of us. Sounds a little harsh, right? That's Dogen from Shobo Genzo. Now here's a comparison, non-Buddhist, from a poet who lived, walked the earth at the same time, actually, as Dogen. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. Wherever you are, whatever you do, be in love. And that was written by the Muslim mystic Rumi. Some of you may know Rumi. Actually, according to the internet, believe everything you see on the internet, he's the most popular poet in the United States in terms of book sales. He lived, 800 years ago. So very different perspectives. Do not cling to love, or you'd be as foolish as the behavior of birds and beasts. Or whatever you do, wherever you are, be in love. Okay, I want to ask you to vote, because I know how that turned out last time. One more comparison, then I'll stop on the comparisons. This is another Zen text. Also a pretty famous one. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. And that's from the poem Faith Mind by the third Zen patriarch. And everybody knows that hate is bad, so if you read it without the hate, it just says, when love is absent, everything becomes clear. Versus a non-Buddhist text for comparison. Let us love one another, for love comes from God, because God is love. Love your neighbor as yourself. And that's from the New Testament of the Bible. So again, very different feelings expressed about love. And then, you know, so as I was reading this, thinking about love, I wanted to make sure I wasn't, you know, going off the deep end. There is something in the Buddhist literature that is, for me, well, disturbing. And I think it's kind of why we don't talk a lot about love. And I'm not talking about Kanado in particular, I'm talking about Zen in general. But what is, you know, what are those statements about? What are those Buddhist statements about that I read? Well, they're about the principle of non-attachment. That's what they are, right? They're expressions of the principle of non-attachment. Well, from non-attachment, it's just a few baby steps to mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is observing, kind of step back, observing, but without reacting or judging. So from non-attachment, pretty close, you go to the practice of mindfulness. And so here's a question. I won't ask you to vote, but I'll give you a second to think about it. Can you practice mindfulness and love at the same time? Can you do it? Is it possible? Well, we've been talking a little bit about love. I'm going to get to that answer, or my answer for that in just a sec. We've been talking a little bit about love, and you know, love, when you really think about love, you don't need a lot of extra words. But sometimes you hear an adjective in front of the word love to kind of give some emphasis. Sometimes you hear the word true love. Or you might hear the word authentic love. Or you might hear the word unconditional love. I think the unconditional love is a hint. It actually is a message for me. And so, Because if something is unconditional, then there's no condition. And that means there's no attachment. So unconditional love is non-attachment love. So my message is, the way to practice non-attachment is inside love. That's the place to practice non-attachment. Inside love. And I think if you keep practicing non-attachment, inside love, at some point, you surrender to love. When you surrender to love completely, then you reach divine love and divine joy. Like this, divine love, divine joy together. And they call Buddha the happy one. Okay, well, that's probably maybe my most important message tonight. So I hope you at least ponder that. Non-attachment, inside love. Love is very big. God is love. Buddha is love. Love is everything. All you need is love. But I have to say something nice about Buddhist literature. I don't want you to think I totally want to dump on Buddhist literature, because that's not the case. So tonight, we chanted the Metta Sutra, the Loving Kindness Sutra. Now, I wish that was a Zen sutra. It's not a Zen sutra, actually. It's a Pali, it comes from the Pali Canon. It predates Mahayana Zen Buddhism, but it's a nice sutra, so we know why not. It's a Buddhist sutra, and so actually, I don't think we're, in fact, I'm sure we're not the only Zen center who chants it. It's a lovely sutra, it really is. And in particular, the a couple lines that we chanted tonight. With a boundless mind should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire over the entire world. That's really, really beautiful. Interesting, though, I will say, is the word love, in this case, suffusing love over the entire world. Love is in the Pali metta. That's the word metta. And this is a short verse section out of that Pali Canon. It's probably one of the most translated of all the scriptures, the Buddhist scriptures, in English and, of course, other languages. I looked online, I think 17 different translations. I was found this website and had them all lined up. It was cool. And so what I saw was how people translated the word metta. M-E-T-T-A is how you write it in our alphabet. Usually it's written loving kindness. And of course, that's a title, usually the translated title of the sutra. This translator that we picked, and I couldn't actually figure out who actually was the translator, but I'm glad we picked it. I like it. Used the word love. A lot of the translations, you see things like friendliness and what was the other one? I can't think of it. Something like that. But it wasn't, they couldn't quite get themselves to say the word love. It was sort of like, loving kindness. That was kind of as close as they could get. But I'm glad we found one that actually said love. We shouldn't be shy about using that word. So, okay, so I said something about the, you know, maybe the Dhammapada that might be a little upsetting. I just wanted to give you my perspective on the Dhammapada. I don't believe Buddha wrote that. I don't believe it at all. I think somebody a few hundred years later, maybe it was a committee, could have been a committee of clerics somewhere, wrote that. I don't think Buddha would have said that. That's what I feel. I don't think a woman wrote that for sure. I don't think a woman would write something like that. About, let's see, what was it? Seek no intimacy with the beloved. It's tough. Anyway, I just want to tell you, I don't believe Buddha wrote that. I just wanted to share that with you. Now, are there hindrances to loving? Probably, yeah. Are there hindrances that we have to loving? Well, yeah. Yes, there are obviously there are hindrances. What's the biggest one, maybe? When I pondered this question, I thought, what's the biggest hindrance? I think it's most of us have trouble loving ourselves. It's pretty hard to be loving everybody else when you can't be loving yourself. Now, I know that everybody in this room in particular has some love for themselves, because you wouldn't be here if that weren't the case. But a lot of us have trouble loving ourselves. It usually comes from childhood. We're taught, you're not that lovable. And you might be lovable if you behave in the right way. Or maybe you just had such a terrible parent that no chance for you. No chance for you. But even for those who didn't get beaten or sexually abused, a really horrific trauma as a child, a lot of us had subtle ways where we just learned not to be totally accepting. Maybe we just felt our world was not that safe. We just really weren't that welcome in the world. And so we put this armor on to protect us, keep us safe. And it serves a purpose. It's natural. But it only serves a purpose when you're a child. Yet, we carry it around when we're adults. So that's a hard, that's a difficult thing. And to get rid of that armor, you have to heal those old wounds. And that's not an easy task. But it's possible. It's possible. I think, and most people think, you've got to go back and figure out, you've got to go travel there. I go travel there if you want to heal it. But there's other things we can do in the meantime that help. We can help each other, help ourselves. One thing is you can look around the room, look at your neighbor, either out loud if you want, be cool, or to yourself. You can say, you are my other self. You are my other self. And feel that connection. Feel that union that we're all together. You are my other self. So there are things like that we can do that help. When I think of that phrase, you are my other self, I think of another Buddhist word that's very important. We talked about non-attachment, living inside love. That word, the word that comes to my mind when I say and look at you and say, you are my other self, is the word emptiness. That might surprise you. How does that connect? Well, emptiness means no distinction. So when I see you and know that we're the same, there's no distinction. So that's a practice of emptiness. you are my other self. So it's another key Buddhist practice I'd like to share with you. Another way to look at emptiness. Okay, I'm almost done. There's a quote I want to share with you I like. Where there is love, there is life. And that's from Mahatma Gandhi, which is another way of saying love is the force of creation. So, in conclusion, love and Buddhism, can they go steady? Yes. Why? Because we can make it so. So I hope you vote yes for love. And let's love each other and talk about it.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
When you said that emptiness is like a connection that you have with others, I read Thich Nhat Hanh's translation of the Heart Sutra, and he said that the patriarch who compiled the Heart Sutra might have been a poor translation, and it might lead to people to misinterpret emptiness as this kind of nihilism, or that there is no purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
But the way Thich Nhat Hanh translates it is that it's emptiness of a separate self.
Mm-hmm.
So emptiness, you know, I am not me. I am connected to you and this whole group and universe.
Mm-hmm. Right. You so are that, my other self.
I think it has to do with love and connection. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I worry especially people who are not really well versed in Buddhism. They hear words like that and they get turned off. Because it sounds like, you know, why do I want to be, somebody's teaching me to love you, and they're teaching me about emptiness. And it's like, why do I want emptiness? Or why do I want non-attachment? So, yeah, I totally agree with that perspective. I wish, we kind of got the words we got because it historically is embedded in the religion.
I know in our library we do have Thich Nhat Hanh's translation.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah, I'd be interested to read it. I really totally 100% with that.
Cool.
So are you saying that when we have our separate needs and we try to satisfy that, that's kind of out of like a fear of not getting our needs met, kind of?
Well, we operate out of fear a lot. Fear and pain are big drivers for most people. That's how they live their lives. Usually it's not conscious, but it impacts their behavior, the way they interact with other people and how they take care of themselves. So it's not an easy thing, but it's kind of everybody's task is to figure that out for themselves.
The first two Buddhist passages which you selected dealt with love as inherently leading to fear or other unpleasant personal emotions.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I think they're, I would first characterize them as traditional forms of speaking the doctrine of non-attachment. I don't like that form. I think we should get rid of it, but I think that's what it is. and it's maybe a lot of those things come out of a monastery setting, and certainly traditionally in the monastery setting there was no no spouses, no, you know, none of that. It's all celibate, at least supposed to be. I don't, who knows what really happened, but it was supposed to be all celibate. And so these things were, if you think of it, you know, you can sort of like give it a pass, you know, because, and if you think of it, okay, hey, it's 2,000 years ago, it's from a monastery. What do you expect? Well, I don't know. I would have hoped for something different, but that's what it is. So I think you just see it in context and know that it's a different time and a place, and they were, and again, I don't think Buddha would have ever said that. It was just the people who wrote it down thought that was the best way to do it. So I think if you look at it that way, then you can, you just take it in context and you can move on. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to live by it.
So I heard in Sanskrit, Maitreya means friendliness. Metta came from that word. So friendliness, maybe more.
Friendliness, right.
Yeah, is resonate to this metta than love, I feel. But.
Right. That's traditionally loving. That was a word I think I was searching for, friendliness. Or maybe I said that, I can't remember exactly. It's how it's usually translated. Friendliness, sometimes loving kindness, pretty popular. Love, not so often, but it is in our translation. But yeah, friendliness, it's very often translated.
Yes. And another one is, so when we have a self-love, most of the time I think my needs are more important than others, so it kind of sucks myself into my needs focused things than others. I mean, when you have a self-love, it's like a whirlpool, sucks ourselves inside, so it doesn't make us flow with the other, the river of people. So how to come out of this and balance both ourselves and others? Because if you are totally thinking about others, sometimes they exploit us, and that is also a thing make us to be ourselves. So how to balance without losing the both sides? Yeah.
Right. That's a good question. Well, if I understood you correctly, and I may not have, but one part was about how do you go from taking care of yourself to accepting and loving other people. And I think it's natural. If you intellectualize about it, it might be cumbersome or problematic. But people, especially, you know, the Vipassana people, and I wouldn't mind seeing it here, or they practice loving kindness. I mean, really, really practice it. You know, over and over again, loving kindness. They always start with themselves. They might go on retreat and they might spend 3 days just repeating, I love myself, I love myself, I wish peace for myself. They have some short mantra or something. And then there's also tricks where they'll think about particular imagery if they're having trouble, because a lot of people, they don't love themselves. It's tough. You can say that, well, I love myself, and like, it's not working, because I don't love myself. And so there are kind of mental tricks that people use to try to make it catch hold. You think of something, for example, said something nice to you, and you try to penetrate that. Why did they say something nice? You know, they were really nice to me. They really liked me. I am worthy of love. And work on that, and work on that, and work on that. And they always start with the self. Always start with the self. And then only, you know, kind of like myself, kind of love myself. And really feeling it in your heart. Then you start to work on with other people. Oh, I love you too. I love you too. So it isn't easy. And then the last part of your question, if I got it, was like, you know, will people take advantage of you and so on? Well, yeah, I mean, you gotta, you have to have your wits about you, so to speak, right? I mean, it's, you do, you need to protect yourself. Look for opportunities to share love. Look for opportunities, what's a, like a bumper sticker, practice random acts of kindness. You know, look for those opportunities. Oh, I could say something nice to the clerk at the store. You know, take those opportunities, look for them, and let that feeling grow.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad you mentioned Leonard Cohen. And then I happen to...
I'm having trouble hearing.
No problem. It's a coincidence that you mentioned Leonard Cohen. And then, you know, he talked about just... I happen to think about him quite lately because his song, Hallelujah. And then he has such passionate, you know, relationship, intimate relationship with God, whatever. He's a Jew, you know, by default, and he's a Jewish, and then he also ordained as a Buddhist in his later days. Something puzzles me is this: in the end, he seems still, you know, he has this question about he himself and God. He said, "Oh God, you know, your love is broken. It's so cold, right?" That's he sings in Hallelujah. And then in the end, you know, he still say, "Oh, you want this darker." You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. He seems to have this such intimate, passionate honesty with God or himself, the Buddha. And then where's the detachment? Where's the emptiness there? You know, maybe he's still stuck there. I don't know. Maybe because he, by default, he's a Jewish. You know, he may still waiting for his Messiah. I don't know. I don't know why I ask this question. I've been thinking about Leonard Cohen recently a lot. I think prayer question about love, and he has been, you know, he's such a beautiful soul, but he has been so painful in the same time. And then where's the detachment out there? I don't have an answer. I'm just, you know, thought.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if I have a question, but something. For me, the detachment is when I accept the pain that somebody may cause me. And I love them anyway, as sort of saying, you know, this person may end up taking advantage in some way, and I'll limit that, perhaps, you know, once I realize what's going on, but that I will continue to love them in spite of that, in a sense. You know, I may need to retreat to a safe distance, but that connection still exists, so honoring the connection. Even if somebody does hurt you, I don't know. Does that make sense? I do have a question for you, Chris. I am wondering, you know, I guess it's something that I've been struggling with in terms of, you mentioned sort of the monastic tradition of Buddhism. There's always sort of this monastic and the lay tradition, and we kind of keep playing around with that a little bit. And how do you see, I guess, that in terms of, you know, I feel like sometimes we are a little bit, what's the word, insular. You know, there's so much suffering out there right here in this Silicon Valley of ours, at work, whatever, every day on the street, every day driving, what are we doing for that? I think we can practice mindful driving, you know, try not to cut people off, certainly. But what can we do on a larger level, I guess, is how do we bring this together, Buddhism that we have inherited from Buddha or the tradition, to our everyday life?
Moment by moment. That's how you do it. each moment. Whatever arises, the situation, you deal with it. If you can help somebody, you can, and then you do it. It doesn't mean it could be driving courteously. It could be planning an event for 100,000 people to save the planet. It doesn't really, it can be any kind of thing, but we can only practice at each moment to try to find the right moment, the right thing for each moment. So you can't do what you can't do, right? You can't help somebody who can't be helped, at least at that moment, who refuses help or who's hostile. Sometimes suffering is, the world is full of suffering. That's certainly no understatement. Absolutely. Chock full of it. It's actually, in some ways, there's a certain peacefulness that comes when you observe it, to see it as it is. It doesn't mean that you like it or want it to be that way or anything like that, but there's a certain peacefulness that comes when you realize what the world is. And from that comes energy. Energy to do things. Energy to live a certain way, take opportunities when you find them to help people. It can be a little thing like driving courteously or planning how to save the planet, you know, or how to help the children at the border. It can be kind of big things. It can be the smile you give to somebody at the store. But it's always moment to moment, and the world has no shortage of suffering. So we're in the right business. So.
I wanted to make some comments. Thank you for that comment, because that really is, I do agree with that. I think moment by moment, we do need to do whatever we can to give love to the world and to our family and to ourselves. But some of the things that we discussed earlier, I think, have kind of a linguistic ambiguity in them. And when you talked about the Heart Sutra, it brought to mind that, and I think we have this new translation in our library. It was done by Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Joan Halifax of the Heart Sutra. They translated the word that we say as emptiness as boundlessness.
Boundlessness?
Boundlessness. Mm-hmm. And when you, that just kind of flips the That's meaning nice. Around completely. Mm-hmm. And gives you the sense, I think, of what the original was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to point that out to, you know, to those of you who might want to study, you know, who are interested in linguistics and would want to study some of the translations. I mean, they go into the Pali and the various forms of Chinese and Japanese that it came through. But word by word, they go through the Heart Sutra, and it just seems to give it a freshness and a power that it might not have had the first couple of times you heard it, you know, in the translations that we use. A lot of us have been puzzled by it when we're first new to Buddhism. And then also I want to say, it strikes me that also a linguistic thing in a lot of the Buddhist writings about love is that what they're warning against is this clinginess or this possessiveness of love. So, I mean, love is something natural to all of us, but if it's this dependent love and this needy love, then it begins to weaken us, you know, on our way. We really can't do much good if we're consumed by, you know, this kind of clinginess of, you know, or intense concentration on just one person in the world, that it means, you know, means everything, and we'd have to have their constant attention. So I think that is something that makes more sense as far as, you know, don't love anybody, or don't be too close to anybody. I think what they're saying is, you know, don't have that needy love. You know, you can have the generous Maitreya type of love, but you know, be less dependent on somebody with your love. Okay, so that was a couple of things. This is a great discussion, and I thank you for bringing up some of these things.
Thank you. I would like to respond by saying, but that's not what they say in that literature. They don't talk about needy love or possessive love. It's seek no intimacy with the beloved, period. So is it true that needy love and possessive love are not so good? Well, yeah, okay. It's the easy thing to accept. But that's not what's written. Unconditional love, but you know, when I'm talking about love, I get your point, Lee, really. When I'm talking about love, I'm not talking about clinging and possessiveness. That's not love. That's not love, right? It's not love. That's fake. That's fake love. That's not real love. Anyway, thank you.
So Buddhism and lots of other religious thinking, philosophy, say, you know, find out what the truth is or deal with the world as it is. So there are two questions or two observations I have. One was said by a Buddhist, non-Buddhist, maybe 80, 90 years ago, and he asked the question, if we really loved our children, why do we have war?
Why do we
have war? If we really loved the children that we have, or the children that we know, why do we have war?
That's a good question.
And then today, as I came here, I met someone and we were talking a little bit. And almost all the good things, and this may be a little bit hard to take, all the good things in life, you know, at least over the last couple of thousand years, 2,000 years is about 100 generations, about 20 years per generation, because at one point people had kids earlier. Today maybe it's a little bit later, but 100 generations is 2,000 years. Almost all the good things that you see came out of war, out of conflict with other people, whether it's building an airplane to get from point A to B, or having better agriculture or whatever. The only bad thing about war is that people die, right? But everything else out of war, the conflicts and so forth, actually help you resolve things in a certain way. And it's actually fairly positive other than the death part. And if you look at death the right way, it may not be that bad.
That's a tough sell.
I mean, as much as we talk about Buddhists all around the world are in conflict with their neighbors, whether it's Sri Lanka or in Thailand or in Burma, Myanmar, and so forth. It just doesn't hold water. I mean, it may hold water for me personally, and it may be how I choose to live life, right? But it's not the way that I see most other people around me living life.
Please clarify, when you say it's not the way, I'm not sure exactly what you're saying, but I have a hard time thinking that war produces good. I know you, I'm not sure. I'm just having a hard time getting my arms around that. But if we, I certainly can resonate with the, if we love our babies, why do we make war? This is a little bit, kind of related, a little bit off that target, but I thought something I'd share with you. I was thinking about the Ten Commandments. And I was looking at the Ten Commandments. I don't know about you, I was raised sort of in a Christian church. As much as I could tolerate it. Anyway, that's a different story. But anyway, I was looking at the Ten Commandments. I was reading, I better not bring up this part, it's too big a topic. I leave it for some other day. But I will say that when you look at the Ten Commandments, one thing you don't notice is something about children. There's nothing about children in the Ten Commandments. And I thought, especially the first commandment, of course you see all the different translations, but something like, you will not have any other God besides me, or something like that, something like that. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we rewrote that commandment and said, and we wrote it this way, my baby is God. But not to encourage you to be a good parent. No. But the literal truth. My baby is God. So that's, you made me think about, you said our children are babies, so I had to add that to the mix. Yes, one more? Getting kind of late, but one more, I don't know.
Maybe one more.
Thank you. This gentleman wanted to say that it is an irony that manifests in a catch-22. And what's funny about how the Buddha died is that he died eating pork in some accounts. And I just wanted to say that. And to add to what Columbine and Lee said regarding lost love, like you said, ambiguity is present in language. It is a pearl, or sometimes, or a pearl diver doesn't seek the pearl at the same spot anymore. That's all I wanted to add. The pearl diver doesn't seek the pearl at the same spot anymore.
And that means, help me out.
I don't think if your love is your pearl, I don't think our chase for like a lost love, we should kind of seek and be attached to it like you were talking about.
We shouldn't be attached to it?
To the same spot and go looking for pearls in the same spot anymore.
Oh, okay, thank you. I think we ran out of time. Thank you all very much.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.